in the studio. His name is Norman Otis Richmond. And I'm just going to read a little bit of something if people don't know who he is. Norman Otis Richmond, ironic broadcast and journalist, will be honored for his significant contribution and commitment to the arts and culture here in Toronto. This is actually from your roast in 2009. I was looking for a bio and this is what I found. And Richmond is a producer and a host of two shows on CKLN, formerly CKLN, now on Radio Regent, Saturday Morning Live. He's worked in extensively throughout radio at CHIN, CFNY, CBC, and CKLN, to now Radio Regent, and on Uhuru Radio. On the internet, he's also a writer and a longtime journalist. I would like to welcome Norman to Roots Reggae Radio.
Oh,
welcome.
How are you? Thank you. Welcome. Thank you.
Yay. So, those of you who follow the radio world within Toronto, you've been around for a long time. So maybe let's go back and talk a little bit how you got to Toronto and a little bit of your journey to Toronto and how long you've been in Toronto. You've been here for a while.
Oh, I've been in Toronto longer than I lived in the United States. I actually came to Toronto in 1967, and I was here for about a year, and I was wanted to be a landed immigrant, but I was deported because I failed the examination. I was not smart enough to be a landed immigrant. They basically said I wasn't smart enough to be a permanent resident of Canada, and I disappeared for many years. And there was a song by the War called Slipping Into Darkness. So I was slipping into darkness for about 7 years, and I was here, there, and everywhere. And then they had an amnesty in Canada, and I applied for the amnesty. There was an amnesty in the United States, and Gerald Ford made it possible for me to come back to the United States if I wanted to. But at that particular time, I had been moving around so much, there was an amnesty in Canada where you could apply to become a landed immigrant, and I applied to become a landed immigrant, and they accepted me at that particular time. And then a few years later, I won the Toronto Arts Award, and the Toronto Arts Award said that I was one of the smartest people in Toronto, and they had my pictures on the bus stops and page Toronto Star color pictures, and they said I was a genius. So I can't figure out whether or not I'm an idiot or a genius. So, but I guess somewhere between those two, that's where I am.
You won the award alongside Austin Clark, Bruce Cockburn, and Karen Kane. Yeah. What year was that?
92. Austin Clark and Bruce Cockburn. I don't know if that was before or after he started doing his reggae thing. He did Wondering Where the Lions Are. I think he did a song with a lot of reggae artists, and Austin Clark had been a friend of mine since I landed in Canada. I mean, he looked after me. He's looked after me ever since I've been here, and I'm still in very close contact with Austin Clark. And Karen Kane was, she was, I guess, the dance, maybe the best ballet dancer that Canada's ever produced, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And Bruce Cockburn.
Cockburn. Oh, he's a legend. He participated with us in a lot of, we had demonstrations against South Africa, against apartheid. Oh, okay. He would be there, and he came out against a lot of the liberation, came out in support of a lot of the liberation movements. Now, what he's doing now, he may have backed off of some of those positions, but his track record is pretty. He supported oppressed people. He was very good at one point, and where he stands now, he made his contribution. Let me leave it at that. Right.
So anyway, you've been in radio for a long time. Maybe talk about your entry into radio. You're also a writer too, and I was just wondering, and a journalist, and so I was just wondering, did you come to writing first or to radio?
Well, my mother tells me that I used to pretend that I was a disc jockey when I was little. I used to play records and talk about this and talk about that, but I used to, my father was a working man, and he worked in an aircraft place, and they made wings for planes. He and my grandfather worked in that, and every time he got paid, he would bring home records. And so I was always around music. He would bring home B.B. King, Bobby Bland, Howlin' Wolf. No gospel, because he didn't go. He very seldom went to church. It was mostly rhythm and blues. My mother tells me he brought Sinatra, but I don't remember that. I don't remember Sinatra. And my sister told me that when we went out and brought Elvis Presley, and he almost had a heart attack, you know, that his children went out and brought Elvis. But I didn't remember that until my sister reminded me of that. So I grew up around a lot of music, and, you know, in order for, I guess I grew up in an area which was, you know, typical United States of America situation. It was gangs, a lot of gangs, and a lot of problems in that area. So I guess my father and mother said they would attempt to get me to. They brought all kind of instruments for me to play: drums, piano lessons, guitar lessons, and they brought a piano. And the piano, I started singing in groups when I was 13 or 14, and everybody used to come to my house to rehearse. And then I tried to run track. I was pretty good at running track, so I ran track, and the music scene. And I recorded when I was 14 or 15, so, you know, I sort of stayed committed to the music that way. And after I graduated from high school, I recorded with a group called M&M and the Peanuts, and they were a pretty big group in Los Angeles. We recorded for Money Records, and Money Records had the group called the Larks, Don Julian and the Larks, and they had a song called The Jerk, which was a big, 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 big hit. And, you know, I toured with, you know, we used to perform with the Miracles and with the OJs and Brooke Benton, you know, people like that. And that's how music, you know, that's how I was into music. And then I stopped singing, basically, because I was always the most militant person in the group. And, you know, I was talking about Islam when I was about, I went to the Nation of Islam. I didn't join, but I started listening to the teachings of Mr. Muhammad when I was 14. And so everybody I sing with, 90% of them, they all converted to Islam. I never did. And they always tell me today, you know, that they were, you know, they because it was because of me that they became Muslims. One of the guys who I used to sing with was Sigidi Abdullah. And Sigidi Abdullah produced SOS Band, Baby Take Your Time, Do It Right, and Donald Byrd and, you know, Eddie Kendricks and Felipe Wynn and, you know, Sagitti just passed away last year. And, you know, with Sagitti, we auditioned for Motown. There was a guy named Sagitti Abdullah, Carl Dice. Well, Sagitti's slave name was Carl Dice, but Ranji Southern, he's Dar Malik El Bay today. He's in New Mexico. And there was another brother who got killed in an automobile accident. Not Carl, but I can't think of his name. It'll come to me. But we auditioned for Marvin Gaye and Harvey Fuqua. Harvey Fuqua was the lead singer of the Moonglows. And Marvin Gaye started out with him, and he recorded Marvin Gaye's Sexual Healing. He's on that. And he, I remember when we were auditioning, he got a call from Etta James from Chicago. And, like, you know, we're like 18 or 19 years old, so, and we're in Los Angeles. So getting a call from Chicago, that's like getting a call from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Back then, we, you know, Chicago, we were, you know, we didn't even get calls from, we were from, Sagitti was from Chicago. My family was from Louisiana, and Dar's family was from Texas and Louisiana. We might get calls from, you know, from Texas, Louisiana, but, or Chicago. I mean, you know, no, Sagitti, we didn't even know Sagitti was from Chicago, so let's strike that. So to get a call from Chicago, that's like I say, getting a call from outer space. And the singing part, well, they put me out. Before they became Muslim, I was always having problems with these groups because I was so outspoken. And then I got drafted and I refused to go to Vietnam, and I, you know, came to Canada, got deported, and went to other cities in the United States. And I came back to Canada and I recorded in the mid-70s. I recorded a couple of three or four reggae tunes. I did Sideshow in a reggae version, and Tell Her Love Has Felt the Need to Leave Her by Eddie Kendricks. I did that in a reggae version. But that was my singing part. In terms of journalism, I basically got involved in journalism through people had got arrested, and I couldn't write because I was a very, very, very poor student. When I say I was a poor student, I didn't really apply myself in school. I basically was I played the fool in school. And when I went to a school called John C. Fremont, and Fremont is famous for, they produce, I guess, more National League baseball players than any other high school in the United States. And we had the a brother by the name of Richard Stebbins. He ran the Olympics with Bob Hayes. He ran the third leg on the relay. And we had people that were, you know, scholars and all that kind of, scholars, and it was more than just athletes. But I got kicked out of Fremont, and I went to Washington High School. Now, Washington High School was sort of integrated. I was put in a situation where I was in with a lot of, you know, white folks and, you know, other nationalities. And I said, you know, I don't want to make the race look bad. Let me, you know, take this book thing a little bit seriously. So that's, you know, I kind of got serious. But Washington High School is a school that Tookie Williams went to. Tookie Williams and Raymond Washington went to Fremont. That's where the Crips started. But also the Fremont is where the many of the leaders of the Black Panther Party, the Los Angeles chapter, Southern California chapter, Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter went to John C. Fremont. Jane Cortez, she went there much longer than we did. But we had a lot of political people. A lot of people went on to become judges and, you know, became integrated in the system. So And, you know, we had the gangbangers. I think someone from Fremont became a Rhodes Scholar. So I was very proud to have gone to John C. Fremont. And I think that my politics came out of just the neighborhood that I came out of, because my father was not a political person at all, but he probably disliked the police more than Huey P. Newton. He was not a militant guy, but he really disliked the police. He taught my sister that if she was ever stopped by the police to demand a woman officer, which she always did. And the police were a big problem in Los Angeles. I think that politicized a lot of us, in including myself. So, you know, the politics came out of, you know, basically the neighborhood. And then I started reading, you know, all of the books and stuff.
So when did you start writing?
The first book, I read a book called Before the Mayflower by Lerone Bennett. And in that chapter, there's a chapter in there where he talks about a woman named Mary. I think her name was Mary Turner. And she was, the Klan took her somewhere in, I think it was Valdosta, Georgia, somewhere in Georgia. And she was pregnant, and they cut her stomach, burn her up, cut her stomach open, and stomped the baby. And when I read that particular book, you know, I said, I'm not going to fight in Vietnam. This is like, I mean, I knew that was just a thing. When I just said, this is,
right,
I can't handle that, you know. And, you know, like I say, listening to my father talk when he rarely talked, I knew, you know, that, and then listening to, you know, the Nation of Islam. I was going to the Nation of Islam when I was 14, but I never really joined because I was 14. But it made some of it made sense to me. I was listening to a guy by the name of John Shabazz, who now is Allah Akbar Muhammad. He's with the Nation of Islam still. He's a big man with Farrakhan. But I started listening. I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and I really couldn't write. When I say I couldn't write, because like I say, I was learning. Because like I say, I really didn't start concentrating on the school things until I was in just finishing high school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people started getting arrested that I knew, and I came to Canada. And the Sir George Williams thing took place. Sir George Williams took place in Montreal, where the students, I think it was Rosie Douglas, Ann Coos, and a number of people that I knew personally were involved in this. So I started writing about in defense of that. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Detroit, and I started writing. There was a newspaper in Detroit called the Inner City Voice done by the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. I wrote for them. But we had a newsletter in Toronto called Harambe, which we started. We had a group called the Afro-American Progressive Association. Afro-American was supposed to mean African people from the whole Western Hemisphere. And some of the Caribbean people didn't like that. And we were basically saying, the term came from a Caribbean man by the name of Carlos Cooks, who was from the Dominican Republic. And he said that all black people in the Western Hemisphere were Americans. And the Cubans took that position. So we had a lot of problems. Oh, we're not African, Afro-Americans. We're Caribbean and a lot of. So we had a lot of fun with that. But I guess it was kind of arrogant, because it was three people that started the organization. One was from Aruba and two were from the United States. But we were basically coming from Carlos Cooks. We weren't coming from the point of view that everybody was a black American. We were coming from the point of view that all of us were African people in the Western Hemisphere. So we started that position, the group, the Afro-American Progressive Association, and we had this newsletter called Harambe, which is a Swahili word for let's pull together. And I started writing there. Then I went on to try to write for the Inner City Voice. And then in 19, I was back and forth between, like I was underground. In 76, I wrote an article for the Contrast newspaper on Gil Scott-Heron. I found it the other night. Yeah, I might even have it here. Gil Scott-Heron, in 1976, I found the interview that I did with him in 1976. And then I didn't get paid. I didn't get paid for that because Al Hamilton was the publisher of the newspaper. Arnold August was the editor. He wouldn't print anything that I wrote. He didn't think I was good enough. Plus, we used to have these discussions, and he had gone to college, and I had barely graduated from. I went to junior college, and so we had that kind of discussion. And then Daryl Hawaii, who is in Vancouver now, he let me write, and I published a Gil Scott-Heron article. And then Daryl took over. Bromley Armstrong started a newspaper, the West Indian Observer. I can't think of the name of the paper. I'm having too many senior moments. But Bromley Armstrong had this newspaper, and Daryl Hawaii and Jojo Chinto were the editors. And I wrote an article on Betty Wright. Betty Wright went on to tour with Bob Marley, and he worked with Peter Tosh and so on and so forth. And what happened was I got paid for that Betty Wright article. That was the first time I ever got paid for an article when I wrote about Betty Wright. And then Bromley's newspaper and Mr. Hamilton's newspaper, Contrast, merged, and Bromley basically dropped out of the newspaper business. And I started writing a column I wrote a number of columns for Contrast. And that's how basically I got started. And then eventually I wrote for the Star, the Globe, the National Post, the United Nations. And one of the editors of the Contrast was a young man from Barbados named Harold Hoyt, who started the Barbados Nation. He allowed me to be published in the Nation, so I was published in Barbados. And I always wanted to be published in the Jamaican Gleaner. Always. That was one of my dreams, because Paul Robeson had been published in the Jamaican Gleaner. I didn't know. I sent an article to the Jamaican Gleaner. They published it and didn't put my name on it. And I didn't realize that the Jamaican Gleaner was the slavery paper. So I don't feel that bad, because I know they were the colonial paper. So I was publishing. I always wanted to be publishing the Jamaican Gleaner, because Paul Robeson was publishing the Jamaican Gleaner. So I was publishing the Jamaican Gleaner, Barbados Nation, and Buffalo. I found an article that I wrote on Peter Tosh. It was published in a Buffalo newspaper, online. I've been publishing all over online, but in terms of just the hard copy stuff, and that's what people give you credit for, not the other stuff. But that is how I started in terms of the
writing.
The writing, and then in terms of the radio thing, I started working at CIUT, which at that time was I forgot what it was called. Radio Varsity. It used to be called Radio Varsity.
Yeah, Radio Varsity. Yeah.
That's where I started I started a show there called Around the Black Community. And I interviewed The Miracles, Billy Griffin. That's after Smokey left. I remember I interviewed the OJs, Walter, William. No, pardon me, not Walter, Eddie LaVert, Walter Williams, and Sammy Strain. I remember I interviewed them. And then I went to CFNY. Yes, CFNY. Dave Marsden. I wrote an article about Mar. I wrote for the Toronto Star, and I went to California and Louisiana, and there was an editor by the name, I can't think of this guy's name, one of the best editors I've ever wrote for. It's a white dude who was really positive towards me. I mean, he really, I have to think of his name before I finish this interview. But he let me go to California, and I interviewed Abby Lincoln. I interviewed Todd Bridges when he was on. Todd Bridges was on, what's the name of that show? Todd Bridges and the other guy who just passed away, the little, yeah, Webster and.
Oh,
yeah.
Different
Strokes, yeah. 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 Dick Anthony Williams, who played Malcolm X, and Dick Anthony Williams was a great actor from Los Angeles. I interviewed, what's the brother's name? The coach, Gremlin coach, Ed Robinson. Ed Robinson, who was used to be the biggest coach in football. He my aunt actually played point guard for him when she was in high school, and my mother was a pretty woman, so she didn't want to get into that. She used to tell me she was in love with it. All the women loved Eddie Robinson. He was a young guy, and he was a coach, and you know, he became famous. But I interviewed him, and I came back and did a lot of that basically opened up the door for me to go on CFNY, because I interviewed Dave Marsden as well. So when Hedley Jones left CFNY, David called me and asked me, did I want to take that spot on, that was 10 o'clock on Tuesday night, CFNY. And it was a reggae show. So I said, yeah, I'll take the show, but I have to be able to play reggae plus. So I played, I remember one day I played Oscar Brown Jr.'s Bid 'Em In. Other than after that, I played, do you remember the days in slavery? And someone called me from Buffalo, New York, a white guy. He was foaming at the mouth. Because, you know, Oscar Brown, it was like Bid 'Em In was like basically doing the bid for this black woman during a slavery time. And then Spear came in with the Do You Remember the, and that guy just basically went nuts. And you know, I played mostly, and that was 90% reggae, but I would play Peabo Bryson. You know, I was always a love song guy, played some love songs and a lot of reggae. And living in Toronto, I knew that Jamaicans, in particular, the soft tunes, as Jamaicans call them, it wouldn't be a problem, you know. It wouldn't be, you know, so. I played the reggae and the, you know, the political stuff, Gil Scott-Heron. I remember one time I played this song about, and the dogs in the MF streets. And one guy, I mean, he used the term, and guy said he almost had a wreck. He was driving his car on the freeway, because it's a poem called, a poem for Jose Torres Campos, right. If you listen to that poem, I mean, Gil is, Chicano brother got killed in the United States. And CFNY, and then after CFNY, I came to CKLN. And when I came to CKLN, I had a sponsor by the name of Michael Thompson. I don't know what Michael Thompson is. Jamaican brother who used to have a stereo village. He paid me. He became my, I was at that time, I was really financially in bad shape. He paid for me, like sponsored that show on CFNY for quite a while. And that kept me afloat. So I came to CKLN when they were in the basement, and you know, until they became defunct, I was with them. And you know, then I did some freelance for the CBC and all those particular people. And the Uhuru Radio people asked me to join them the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, Omali Ishatila, wanted me to do a show. They asked me, and I accepted that. And so right now I'm doing Radio Regent along with my interviewee.
Saturday Morning Live.
And Uhuru Radio. And Saturday and Sunday, I'm on radio every week.
So maybe take listeners, like, what you've interviewed so many people. What it was your most impactful interview?
Impactful interview?
Yeah. Or most interesting?
Remember talking to Betty Carter. I mean, she was the most difficult. Betty Carter, the jazz singer, she was very, very difficult. Wasn't so hard. Wasn't nothing personal, but I mean, she's had such a high standard of music. You know, like, I would be talking about different artists, and she just, he can't play, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, she was just a... her standards were so high, and she was kind of an elitist. And when it came to music, I mean, like, I don't think she liked popular music, be it reggae, calypso, rhythm and blues. I mean, if you weren't doing her type of jazz, and I might be wrong, but she just struck me that way. I remember I loved to interview Max Roach, the drummer Max Roach, and I used to call him maybe three or four times a year. And sometimes he told me, he said, "No, you're a persistent Negro." And he started talking to me, and then the first time I saw him, he came to Toronto. He invited me to come to his stay with him for a while. And the first time I saw him, he walked away from me. And the next time I saw him, it was like I was his son. But I understand, well, Max was a very complex sort of guy. But, I mean, he used to talk to me about what was taking place in the 40s. Like, in the 40s, there was a guy by the name of Cuffy Gunnabah, Guy Warren. And he was a musician. And there's a book about it. Robin Kelly has a book out where it talks about him and Randy Weston and some more people. But anyway, Cuffy Gunnabah, he said that they used to wear kente cloth in the 40s. He was saying, "You guys think you guys are into this black thing." He said, we had that stuff, you know, like in the 40s. We studied Islam in the 40s. And, you know, some of us went to Africa in the 50s. And, you know, it's like, you're not really breaking any new ground, because, you know, the whole question of Africa is, you know, been with some of us forever. Max was always a good interview. Archie Shepp was like a real idol of mine. He's still living, and he basically gave me the concept of diasporic music, of music of black people from Brazil to, you know, like the music the black people in the Western Hemisphere did. And I'm really nowhere near as good as I should be, because most of the stuff that I do is English. I have to be self-critical, because black music in the Western Hemisphere is French, Spanish, Dutch. What do they speak in Aruba, Curacao, Bonaire? Papiamento. I mean, yeah, you know, Papiamento. But basically I'm a... English people, English-speaking people, we're lazy. No, it's true. No, English people, because, I mean, I met people from Aruba that can speak Papiamento, Spanish, English. I mean, you know.
French, yeah.
Yeah, French, and with no problem. But we...
Can switch,
as,
yeah.
We as English people, as English-speaking people, yeah.
Yeah, maybe talk about. I want to hear about your, you know, interviews with Tosh. How was that?
me and Peter Tosh got along extremely well. We hit it off. Yeah, we hit it off. I met Peter Tosh in 1978 in Los Angeles. And I was, my mother used to take me, she used to take me around when I went to California. And she liked to be around people like that. So we went, I think we were in Santa Monica. And they were staying in this hotel. And at that time, he had Sly Robbie and what's the pretty boy that used to play keyboards? Touter? Is it Touter? My wife used to be crazy about this brother. He was he played with a it's Touter, young guy. Yeah, he was he played with that group that did the thing about the Big Brother, the Jacob Miller's group. What was Jacob Miller's group's name? Touter was there. Touter, Sly, Robbie, and Peter. And we had to wait outside for Peter. And Peter was listening, watching the wide world of sports. So they were having the sacrament, and Peter was using all of the colorful language. My mother didn't know what he was talking about, and we were standing outside, and I was just laughing to myself, you know. So he was on fire. He was watching. They were watching the wide world of sports. So when we came in, it was so funny. So I'm there with my mother. So he immediately became Saint Peter Tosh. So he invited my mother to Jamaica and la 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 la. So he, you know, that was the first time I met him. And then we went to see him at the, he played at a club. He played at a club, Sly and Robbie, and he backed, Sly and Robbie, Touter and those guys. Touter was playing keyboards. And the next day, we went to Santa Barbara to see Bob Marley and the Wailers. And Peter came there with Mick Jagger. Now, I was backstage, but I don't know what this particular thing. I understand that Bob did not let Peter on, well, he let Peter on stage, but he refused to let Mick Jagger. That's my understanding. But anyway, Peter came out and sang "Get Up, Stand Up." They sang that together. I remember I was there for that, and I remember meeting Don Taylor at that particular time. Don Taylor, who was Bob's manager, and Don Taylor had managed Little Anthony Imperials, and he had a reputation for being a damn good manager. But you know, he was problematic, because I'd asked him about doing an interview with Bob, and he was giving me a whole lot of nonsense about come to see him in his office. And I said, well, I don't even live in Los Angeles, I live in Canada now. And Sly Dunbar was looking at him, and he kind of shook his head. But I met Peter. I used to see Peter every time he came to Toronto. And the last time I saw him, I think we went to Third. They had this big limousine. And I was with him the whole day. Peter, Charlie, there was a white guy, an Irishman, crazy Irishman, who was a publicist for Bob, this Irish fiddle band. They were on Island Records. Bob, Charles Cummer was a publicist for all of these particular guys. Charles was a crazy, insane Irish guy. He took a liking to me. So he had got Peter this limousine. So I spent this whole day with Peter. So we went by the Third World Bookstore, and you know, Peter bought a bunch of stuff, and we went by Dundas and Jarvis, and he bought these goggles, and I think I've seen pictures of him with these with these glasses on, and we had dinner and we argued, and I remember this song came on. Some people are nah. How about us? He sang the whole song. I said, man, I thought you didn't like love songs. He just bust out laughing. He said, what kind of music do you think I make love to my girlfriend, my woman to? And I just bust out laughing. So he was like, he laughed a lot. He laughed a lot. And we were always arguing about politics and the ism. He was always talking about ism, schism. And I said, you know, there's two types of, you know, economically, you can only go capitalist or socialism leading to communism. Yep. And he was
ism, schism.
You know, he would always be doing the Rasta thing. And I remember one time we got him in this room. We were talking about South Africa, and there was maybe about 10 of us in this particular room, and we were arguing with him about going to South Africa. And he was saying that, you know, he was using, you know, the Jamaican good words. And he was talking, he was cursing, and we say, Peter, can't go to South Africa. And he was basically saying, who does say I can't go to blah, 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 blah. I mean, he just went off. And about a week later, we picked up the Globe and Mail and says that Peter Tosh, after meeting with black militants in Toronto, has refused. He's not going to perform in Israel or South Africa. I knew Peter pretty well. Yeah. And, we got along. Yeah. We got, I used to ride with him I did a tour with him. They went to, Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal, and I used to spend a lot of time with him, and we'd be arguing all the time, African history. I guess he kind of liked me because I knew I could keep up with him on the African stuff. So, you know, he would talk about the African Americans and the problems he had with some African Americans and some of the strengths and the weaknesses of the unity of, and he talked about Trinidad and the whole Calypso thing, and because he went to Trinidad and made some statements about Calypso and got in trouble down there, and the only time I understand that he refused or he would put his joint out was in Grenada. Yeah, they wanted him to, you know, the brothers wanted, he said, you know, the brothers want you to, you know, kind of cool it with the herb. And he said, you know, he did that. But they call him a comrade or something. So he basically says he didn't come red, he came black, you know. But he did show a little respect for the New Jewel movement, Maurice Bishop and the guys.
So I know where we're at. I mean, you've been in Toronto, working in Toronto on radio. How's your experience working in Toronto in radio? And how do you sort of survive as, you know, with the work that you do, and then also, you know, just keep on going? For so long,
I guess it's just being stubborn, because a lot of the money situation is not there anymore, because a lot of the, you know, so-called top people from CBC and Global, and they can't find work, and politically, my problem is, politically, I am viewed as being too radical for the mainstream. So I used to get upset about not being able to find work, but you know, right now hardly anyone is working, but it's basically, you know, finding other things to do to supplement yourself. And the journalism thing is that's part of our struggle. So, you know, I have to do that as long as I can open my mouth and can keep my memory together. I plan to do it, but it's right now it's just something that I think we need independent journalism. So I plan to keep at it as long as, you know, as long as I can keep my memory together. Yeah.
Well, maybe take listeners, because you're working on a big project. You've been working on it for a while. So I don't know, you could tell a little bit what you want of that project.
You're talking about the book idea?
Yes, the book.
I have a book. We'll deal with one book. I basically have a compilation of stuff that I've started writing, that I've been writing. And basically what I'm going to do on this first book is put together a series of columns that mix politics and music, and mix. It's more of a diasporic or a pan-African type of thing, because like I've talked to everyone from Burning Spear, and you know, I've talked about Bessie Smith. I met Fela personally. Max Roach, you know, I spent a lot of time with Mr. Roach and with his wife, Abilinka Naminata Museka. And I basically want to put all of that together for this generation of people, because I think this generation of people, there's going to be another wave coming, and people are going to recognize that. So that's basically the project. So it'll be a compilation of articles that I have, you know, wrote in Contrast, in Share, in the Globe and Mail, the Star, National Post, and Jamaican Gleaner, Barbados Nation, and put them in one package so people can see them. I've been in a big argument with people now. A lot of people that I respect are telling me, there's nothing wrong with self-publishing, but before you do the self-publishing thing, try to get an agent and, you know, get someone to get your publisher. Yeah. Right. So, you know, that's basically where I'm at now. Right.
Yeah, right. Maybe talk a little bit about, because you've been very instrumental in sort of documenting and also connecting, you know, specifically the Black community or the Black music scene in Toronto. Maybe talk a little bit about, you know, the association and that kind of stuff, because I think a lot of people don't know that at all.
Well, the Black Music Association was it's not really in existence right now, but. The Black Music Association, the Toronto chapter, was started by Milton Blake, myself, Salome Bay, Diane Liverpool, Garth White, Zola Loli. Zola, he's had the food thing now. There's another brother, Wayne Lawson. These were some of the foundation members of Black Music Association here in Toronto, but it really started in Philadelphia. Kenny Gamble, Luke Mon, Kenny Gamble, and another guy by the name of Ed Wright started the Black Music Association in 1979. They had a meeting, I think it was in Florida, and they had people like everybody from Berry Gordy on down was at this particular meeting, and they basically said they were going to start this association. So they went to the White House in 1979, June 1979, and basically got Jimmy Carter, who was the president at that time, to proclaim June Black Music Month. Some of the people that were there were like Evelyn Champagne King, Chuck Berry, I think Little Richard was there, Billy Eckstein, Charles Mingus was there, the bass player. He was in a wheelchair at that particular time. Max Roach and Dizzy Gillespie, Jimmy Carter asked him to do Salt Peanuts, and he said, Dizzy said he would do it only if Jimmy Carter would sing it. And he did butcher it. And then they made June Black Music Month. And that was a big high point in black music, because the Black Music Association was attempting to bring together all types of music. They had put together Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder. There's a picture by the name. There's a picture with, if you go on the YouTube, you can, yeah, not YouTube, but on the internet, you can Google, you can see a picture of Bob and Stevie Wonder, three or four different pictures. Those photographs were taken by Kwame Brathwaite. Kwame Brathwaite is the brother of Elombe Brath, and Kwame Brathwaite, these brothers are first generation American guys whose parents came from Barbados, and these guys have been, any significant fact that you mentioned, you're going to see Lombe and Kwame. When the Jacksons went to Africa the first time, when Michael Jackson was maybe 14, Kwame Brathwaite went with them to Senegal, and he's got all of those photographs. When in the boxing match, when Ali and Foreman fought in Zaire, the Rumble in the Jungle, Kwame and Elombe were there. I'm saying all that to say that the BMA, Kwame Brathwaite was close to the BMA. So the whole idea basically was to deal with black music, not just American black music. And we kept the Black Music Association going for 5 or 6 years. We used to have, we had a talent search. The last BMA convention was in 1983, I believe. We went to Miami Beach, and we brought a band from Hamilton down to represent Canada in the talent search. And you know, at that particular, I remember the last meeting we had, this guy by the name of John Martin, who was the head of City TV, next to Moses Nimer. He passed a couple years ago, John Martin. He asked me, he said, you want to go in and have dinner? Now, he took me to this place where, you know, they had all these, this is the big hotel in Fountain Blue in Miami Beach. So, you know, I was going to go to Burger King or, you know, someplace. So he says, look, come on here. So we walk into this joint, and there's Don Taylor sitting next to P.J. Patterson. You know, that's P.J. Patterson. You know, P.J. Patterson soon would become the Prime Minister of Jamaica. So there's Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff, there's Millie Jackson. I mean, you know, like all of the, you know, all of the heavyweights. This guy by the name of Dave Clark. Dave Clark was about 100 years old. He was one of the first PR men. I mean, this guy was a great record man. So we go in there, and you know, I see all of these all these people, and that was the last time the BMA was in existence. When we came back, we started promoting Black Music Month. So we went to I think it was Mel Lastman, and he was June Rollins first, and then Mel Lastman, and then Mel Lastman did the statement about black people eating each afraid to go to Mombasa because they might put him in soup, boil him. So we basically stayed away from him for a little while. Then he came back aboard, and and We tried to get a Ford to do a proclamation. He did it this year for the first time, I guess, after all of the pressure. Not from us, but from he was under so much heat. And he actually put me on his mailing list, so I get all of his. Well, I haven't gotten anything recently, but right. You know what he's doing. So, no, that was the whole question of Black Music Month. But Black Music Month, the problem, I think, with Black Music Month is that we didn't start an event. You know, some sort of, by now we should have had something.
Like an ongoing kind of thing.
Yeah. Black Music Month now, basically, a lot of the younger people are urban, so not Black music. Some people, not all, don't want to deal with Black music. They're urban, and they don't want to deal with, they feel that they're being restricted. And sometimes the system is promoting urban music over Black music because it's a divisional thing. Some of it has to do with age. There are a few of our Black younger people that don't want to deal with Black or African, you know.
Right. That's kind of, when do you think that kind of change began?
I think it began when the movement was, when it appeared that our movement was crushed. You know, we had the big movement in the United States, and, you know, by the early 80s, that had simmered down. The Caribbean rose up at that particular time. You had Nicaragua, you had Grenada, and then Bishop and those brothers were killed. They killed Walter Rodney. So the movement in the Caribbean was cooled out, and the African on the African continent, you know, with the exception of Robert Mugabe, who a lot of people have bought the line that he's a problem. I mean, Mugabe, as far as I'm concerned, is standing up. He might be kind of hard around the edges, but he is, he's not doing anything wrong. And so basically we don't have a movement at this particular time. I shouldn't say we have a movement. That's not true. Our movement is weak in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, like, what's happening in Grenada right now? Who's in power in Grenada right now? I never was really a Burnham person, but Burnham, on some levels, on the international thing, Burnham had some, he trained Bishop and those guys, and they did some good work around African liberation. But the Caribbean right now is beginning to build up and sort of break with the U.S. in the sense that when Chavez died, most of the leaders from the Caribbean went to Chavez's funeral. Sister from Trinidad, the young guy out of Dominica. Douglas, I think, is about in his early 30s. But you know, our movement has been devastated, and I think that's what's happening now. The fact that it started with the crushing of the particular movement, but that's a temporary thing. I think people are going to come back. I believe.
So you had sort of a recent visit back to LA, and since you you said that you have been in Canada longer than you have in the States, how was that experience going back home?
It was a very good experience for me, but it's not a problem. It's just a reality that Los Angeles, California, Southern California is different. The Latino community is larger. The Latino community is probably 110% behind Obama. The Black community is is there, but the majority of the African American community or Africans in America, they're into Obama. But the problem with that is that there's no critical. I don't see a lot. President Obama has done so many things that I don't think that can be defended. And I don't know how much longer people are going to be able to support Barack Obama. This whole his drone. I know a lot of people have condemned him about the drone thing, but there's a small movement of people. I remember I went to a thing in one of the theaters, and there was a group of young black people. I would say they were the oldest person there was me, but I would say that the crowd, it was a group of people from around 20 to 40. And I had never heard so much criticism of Obama in my life. These were young black people, mostly women. And they were they were critiquing Obama. But Los Angeles, California has just changed geographically. I went back to the grammar school I went to. I went to a school called Miramani. Now it's 97% Latino. I went to Edison Junior High School, 97% Latino. I went to John C. Fremont High School, 97% Latino. I went to Washington High School, which is now maybe about 60-40. Yeah. So, I mean, the demographics are completely different. When I grew up in California, people were working, and my family had county jobs, so they have prescriptions. If they get sick, they can go to the doctor. But this generation of people, health insurance is zero. People are not working, and not because. But the thing that I found very, when I saw people hustling, selling everything, trying to earn a living, people selling socks, selling Obama t-shirts, singing, selling CDs. One guy came up to me attempting to sell me some Viagra in terms of, I mean, I'm saying people were out there trying to make, I'm talking, and the selling thing is like, I saw certain people that are, the whole thing about people being lazy, it's not really true. I mean, selling everything up under the sun. And, you know, I went to a lot of meetings, and the big problem I have with the meetings is that it's mostly, I don't have a problem with this, it's mostly women, but the age factor, the young people are not involved, like, and they're doing their separate thing.
They're not intergenerational.
It's not intergenerational, because I went to a meeting, a group that there was an anti-police coalition, but mostly women, African, Asian, a lot of gays, a lot of lesbians, but they were young people. Very, 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 very militant. Then you have a lot of the nationalist groups are they're young people, like the you know, they got like a young Black Panther, people that have patterned themselves after the Black Panthers. They are on the ground, and it's not completely, I mean, you can see, but it's just to bring those two components together. There's a lot of people that are concerned, but like LA is not like Toronto, it's huge,
yeah,
huge in terms of the geography. So, you know, it's like,
and it's like, you know, car.
Oh, you don't have, you have to have a car. Yeah, you have to. The transportation system is fairly good. It's fairly good, but you still need a car. You need a car. And Detroit, I shouldn't say Detroit. I haven't been to Detroit in a while, but the community is just it's too spread out, and the system is trying to create a division between the Africans and the Latinos. And there's divisions between the Africans within the African community, and there's divisions within the Latino community, mm-hmm. because all of the Chicanos, and you have people from El Salvador,
right.
and people from El Salvador. I think the late leader of the labor movement is from El Salvador, and I think the Latinos are better organized than the Africans at this particular point. Right now, you have the black newspapers. I write for this paper called Our Weekly. Then you have a paper called The Sentinel. Like that's the oldest paper out there. And the system is really trying to divide the African and the Latinos, because I think it's in their interest to keep that fight going, if they can.
Right. So anyway, we're ending, basically coming to the end of our show. Can you stay for 15 more minutes?
What time is it now?
It's 6:15. I know.
Oh, yeah. No, early. I can actually, yeah.
Okay. So I guess, what's sort of, I guess your hope, in not just, mobilizing, but in sort of keeping sort of independent media and, community media. Since you've been in it so long,
I think the hope is the fact that we have people like yourself and other people that can keep our stuff documented in terms of the archive situation. Like I say, I was listening to going through all of these tapes, so I found this. Interview with Grace Boggs. Now, Grace Boggs is in Detroit. She's a Chinese American who married Jimmy Boggs, who I guess he died in 96 maybe. But they were with CLR James, and they were, Grace Boggs is still in the land of the living, and they work with Malcolm X. And what she's talking about on this particular tape I was listening to last night was the message to the grassroots speech, which was made by Malcolm in November of 1963 in Detroit. He was still in the nation. the speech where he talks about the house Negro, the field Negro, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. So she is talking about how that meeting took place and how there was a split between Reverend Clegg, who became Jeremoji of the Christian Nationalist Movement, and Reverend C.L. Franklin, who was Aretha Franklin's father. So she's basically breaking all of that stuff down as to, like the Franklin's church was mostly Southerners, older Southerners who come from the South, and when Clegg's church was younger people who were like urban people. And there were differences there. And Clegg was a Unitarian or a United Church, and he became the shrine of the Black Madonna. So I mean, I'm just finding stuff like that, and that stuff has to be
archived.
So people can have it. Because if something happens to a lot of people, like Malcolm X, for example, his family just threw his stuff out, somebody found it and they had to buy it back for millions of dollars. But I'm just saying,
right?
Yeah, that
then
is.
We have to keep it.
I was talking to a friend of mine in Chicago. He was basically saying that if he would pass tomorrow, his son would come and throw everything out. No, he was basically. I mean, and there's everybody has these excuses because it's like, oh, it's on cassette, so. We have a big problem in terms of how we're gonna keep
archive.
We have a big problem.
So that's like one thing, and I think also, I mean, just also like the landscape, media landscape, the corporate media has, you know, kind of taken over all sort of airways. and we have sort of an opening on the internet, and I think as independent media voices that we kind of have to jump on, kind of thing. We have to actually sort of build spaces because of, you know, that limited kind of corporate mass media. I don't know of any right now, like on sort of airways, is there any room for progressive voices? I think that's pretty much shut out. So I think the internet is a space right now, and we kind of have to dig deep, build that foundation.
Well, you listen to Stevie Wonder has a station in Los Angeles, and his talk is Steve Harvey. And, you know, Steve Harvey is very problematic. And here in Toronto, we have G98, and the music that they play, as far as I'm concerned, is I give them a 10 musically. I listen to maybe they might play too much U.S. stuff. I mean, I'm from the U.S., but they might play. I could see some people saying they play too much U.S. stuff, but I do hear the all types of music. I have a problem with the soca music that they play. When I say I have a problem with it, because I mean, some of the calypso music, the conscious calypso music, is not some. A lot of it's being shut. I don't hear any conscious stuff. All I hear is the dance stuff. But the music overall is good, I think, on G98. But the talk is real sad, because I mean, here are Caribbean people, you know, people that produced some of the greatest minds on the planet Earth, and you turn on this station and you got these Caribbean people on there talking. I mean, it's sad. It's just, listen, it's like, come on, it's like Walter Rodney. You know, Walter Rodney come out of there, and it's like, if this is the best you can do in terms of a talk show, it's. I mean, some of those talk shows I listen to, supporting the police, supporting the conservative government. It's criminal, really. Really, it's like really criminal, and they don't Dudley Laws is no longer with us, but Dudley was part of they might let Dudley Laws, but that would come on. But I mean, it's and the women and the, I mean, I've never heard them take a position on women or gay, lesbian, or any kind of issues that people are talking about in the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's sort of like, I mean, this is something we probably should look at, but this has been strategic with the conservative government. They've, you know, that's part of their platform, to go into diverse communities.
Let's go get the Sikhs, let's go get the Blacks.
That's the strategy of the Conservative Party. And so you see this within in the Black press all across the country. Like, so what I mean about, you know, progressive voices, it's not about just getting sort of, you know, a show. It's about having independent, not only shows, but like actual infrastructure where you can broadcast your messages that are not sort of have that agenda.
Right, you know? Right, I agree.
So it's not about just programming. It's about actually, you know, carving space in the media landscape.
No, I agree with you completely in terms of not, no, it's program, because we can come up with the programs. We need the space.
Because
I refuse to believe this is a big city with 4 daily newspapers. You got all kind of weeklies, black weeklies, Chinese weeklies. South Asians have their thing. Then we have people that can, that we're literate.
Right.
And politically literate. But the question is, can we get our voices heard? How can we get our voices heard? That's the issue.
Yeah, right. So anyway, I guess, yeah, what do you have anything else to say? We're reaching the end of our show.
Oh, Toronto is a very literate city, politically literate. But I think that, you know, the voices are, if you listen to radio, I listen to all kind of radio. You listen to a sports channel, you'll have people from Nigeria calling in about hockey. You listen to people talking about science. But we need a place where we can control that particular voice, because the right wing station, we have some of the most right wing stations
in the continent.
And black people are listening to that and challenging that. And I've been listening to some of these right wing stations on just recently, and that whole Zimmerman thing. I was listening to some white people who were basically saying that, I mean, they were coming, I couldn't believe it. They were basically saying that Zimmerman should have been convicted. I mean, these are right wing people. They could see that it was just so glaring. But I think we need progressive forces, specifically African people. We need to get our own house in order in terms of how we can transmit our message. And if there are other people that want to come on and contribute, we know how to bring them in too. But we need to control something ourselves very, very, very badly, because we are, we don't want to be controlled by the Conservative Party.
Yes.
Or the Liberal Party. Or the NDP. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So much to talk about. And thanks so much for coming on our show.
No problem.
I get to see you twice this week. And you're welcome back anytime to Roots Reggae Radio, I'm sure. Yeah, you're welcome anytime. And you have been listening to Artists in the City. We have been talking with Norman Otis Richmond. He's a longtime writer, journalist, radio host, and he can also be heard on Saturday Morning Live on Radio Regent .com, and then also on Sundays 2 to 4 p.m. on
Uhuru Radio, uhururadio.com.
Yes.
U-H-U-R-U. That's Uhuru Radio, yeah.
Yes. .com 2 to 4 p.m. on Sundays for his music, his diasporic music show.
And thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for coming again.
All right. All right.
Vibes, go with love inside the natural room. Naturally, you've plugged into 7 miles.
We don't talk much at all. I get old. When the night falls, even when we're on the ball, when I see you,
you plug into the natural groove.